Welcome. Thanks for joining us today. We have a very special panel today. Great conversation. Today we're going to be featuring Trauma, Tresses, and Truth, Untangling Our Hair Through Personal Narratives, with two wonderful guests, Lizette Wagner,
who is a celebrated writer whose work has been featured in over 30 literary journals and anthologies. Wanzer's work appears in over 30 literary journals, books, and magazines. Library Journal named her book Trauma, Tresses, and Truth, Untangling Our Hair Through Personal Narratives, a top 10 best social sciences book. We also have Jasmine Hawken, who is a Philly-based educator, writer, and community organizer serving as president of the nonprofit Urgent 365 Inc., an organization derived from her 2015 poetry chapbook, Urgent Conversations, Race, Reality, and Responsibility.
So I want to thank you so much for joining us. There will be a Q&A at the end, so have your pen and paper ready to write down questions as they come. And the way that you will engage is whatever platform you're watching this panel discussion on, you can just leave your comments in the chat, and we will feature your comments. So without further ado, let's bring on Lizette to set the stage for us. Welcome.
Hello. Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us today. Jason, thank you for having us on and for hosting Trauma, Tresses, and Truth this afternoon. I'm Lizette Wanzer. I'm coming to you from San Francisco, California. My pronouns are she, her, hers. I'm an author, writing coach, and a professional development instructor for creative writers. I'm here to talk about Trauma, Tresses, and Truth, which is a book that came out in late 2022. Subtitle is Untangling Our Hair Through Personal Narratives. But before we, Jasmine and I start to read, I'd like to give some background on this project and how it came to be, a little bit of information about what it's about, and then some statistical information that you might find fascinating. So I'm originally from New York, and I did live in Atlanta for 6 years before I came to San Francisco. I've now been here for about 18 years. For most of my literary career, I've published fiction and poetry, but in the past 5 to 6 years, I focused almost exclusively on nonfiction, which is what this book is. So Trauma, Tresses, and Truths is an anthology. It's a collection of essays, and it's grouped into 4 sections. There are over 20 contributors in the section, and I have several pieces in the collection as well. Each section is prefaced with a poem. So the contributors are Afro-Latina and African-American women authors. Some of them are educators. Part one of the book is called A Critical Lens. Part two is called The Pilgrimage. Part three is called Intimate Encounters. And then part four is called The Unshackled Chronicles. The appendix contains a reader's study guide in the back, suitable for college and graduate students. And there's also a reader's resource guide, which contains lists of books, films, organizations, children's books about natural hair, as well as festivals, and conferences and organizations and salons that address or specialize in natural hair. So what do the essays in this book actually address? So Trauma, Tresses, and Truth examines the complex and convoluted relationship that Black women have with their hair in general around the globe, but particularly in American society. Our natural hair resides on the lower end of mainstream society's beauty assessment scale. So these essays provide a lens into how, into why, and the myriad manners in which the Black body remains misread and misunderstood. Particularly relevant during this time of emboldened white supremacy, racism, and provocative othering, this work explores how writing about one of the still remaining systemic biases in schools, academia, and corporate America might lead to greater understanding and respect. I see this as work that pushes for identities without apologies. The book is available at your favorite local independent bookstore. It's available through my publisher, Chicago Review Press. It's also available on bookshop.org, at Better World Books, and at IndieBound. It's also available at a large franchise bookstore purveyor. And it's available also at The Other Place. However, I would strongly urge you to please purchase from one of the independent online booksellers or your independent local bookstore or a Black and Brown owned bookstore before you would purchase from The Other Place. So, I want to share some sobering statistics with you from Dove's Crown 2021 research study for girls. And just for those who don't know what the Crown Act is, it's protective legislation to protect African-Americans of all genders, to protect their natural hair in workplace settings, and also in academic settings. So CROWN is an acronym. It stands for Create an Open World or Workplace, for in some contexts, for natural hair. And it's also a metaphor, of course, for the crowns on our heads, which is the hair on our heads. Okay. The Crown Act was first postulated and it was first passed in California, right here, in 2020. Then Senator Holly Mitchell, who is now a Board of Supervisors member in Los Angeles, but at the time in 2020 or 2019 when she wrote it, she was a senator and she introduced the bill. And Governor Gavin Newsom, which is our California governor, signed it into law on July 3rd, 2020. And so July 3rd now is a date that's known and celebrated nationally as National Crown Day. So July 3rd, 2024 will be the fourth official National Crown Day. So here are some sobering statistics that I wanted to share with you from that Dove Crown 2021 study that I mentioned earlier. This was the research study for girls. So what do you think about this? 53% of Black mothers whose daughters have experienced hair discrimination say their daughters experienced this discrimination as early as 5 years old. That's kindergarten. 86% of Black teens who experience discrimination say they've experienced specifically hair discrimination by the age of 12. It's about sixth, seventh grade. Black girls are the most vulnerable to hair bias in predominantly white school environments. 100% of Black elementary school girls who attend predominantly white schools report experiencing hair bias. And they're saying that they report that the bias episodes occurred before the age of 10. It's about fifth grade. 47% of Black mothers report experiencing hair discrimination themselves. These are the mothers. 90% of Black girls think their hair is beautiful, but the microaggressions and discrimination they endure has an impact on their self-regard. Black women are 1.5 times more likely to report having been sent home or know of someone who's been sent home from the workplace due to their hair. The impact of formal school discipline due to hairstyle bias or for wearing culturally rooted hair coverings, like a tignon or a scarf or a turban or a gicle, that impact is greatest for girls of color who are wearing such head coverings. And lastly, teenage Black girls miss an average of a week of school per year due to hair discrimination related trauma or hairstyle harassment. So the Crown Act right now, we have that passed, that legislation in over 20 states. I think we're hovering around the 25 state mark at this point. When this book came out, it was only 14 states. And what we're still needing in this country is a national Crown Act, so a federal Crown Act. It has been introduced. Senator Cory Booker has introduced it a couple of times, and it tends to pass the House and then tank in the Senate. So we still don't have one nationally. So what does this mean? This means in California, where we have a Crown Act, my hair is protected. I can wear these locks to work and no one can tell me that they're unprofessional. I can't be sent home from work or from school for that matter because I'm wearing dreadlocks, or if I chose to wear an afro or braids. But let's say I go to a state, I move to a state, I relocate to a state that does not have a Crown Act passed. I can interview for a position there and be fully qualified for it. And that firm or that organization can make a job offer to me contingent on my cutting my dreadlocks or straightening my hair. And I wouldn't have any legal recourse in those states. So I invite you to sign the Crown Act petition to support national level legislation. This should be a no-brainer, okay? But apparently it's not. It's been reintroduced again, okay? Bonnie Coleman has reintroduced it. So there's a link for the petition that I believe Jason is putting into the chat. There it is. You can also find the petition on my website, on my author website, and you can find it on the Crown Act website. So please, I'd like to see this book help advance the needle on getting that National Crown Act passed. I want to mention that in 2021 and in 2023, I also produced a multi-day virtual conference called Trauma, Tresses, and Truth, Interrogating Black Women's Natural Hair. And that conference featured workshops, webinars, panels, and creative writing readings. And this year, it will happen again because I have funding to do it again. So this will be the first back-to-back years that I'm doing this. And this year, that virtual conference, Trauma, Tresses, and Truth, Interrogating Black Women's Natural Hair, it will be August 9th through 11th, 3 days. So again, workshops, webinars, panels, and readings. The registration website will open, and you can find the link through my author website, or if you connect with me on LinkedIn, and that will open in late May, early June. So if you're interested and you'd like to purchase admission passes, you can do that late May, early June. There's also a pre-early bird bunch of free tickets each time that go live before the official tickets, and they get snapped up like that. So if you're interested and you're worried you might miss it, go ahead and contact me through my author website. Let me know you're interested, and I will put you on a special email list to get the free ticket notification. And then there'll be an early bird passes period of about 2 weeks, and then the regular passes will go on sale. All right. So today, Jasmine and I will both be reading from our selections in the book, our essays in the book. And then Jasmine and I will be having discussion. I'll be asking a couple of questions from the study guide that I wrote for the book. And then we'll be opening up to you for your questions as well. So I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to my colleague, Jasmine, who is a contributor in the book, so that you can have a break for my voice joining on, and then I'll come back on and I'll read my passage before we have our discussion. So Jasmine, take it away.
Thank you. Hello, everyone. Lizette gave a beautiful introduction to the book, which I will be reading from, and my essay is called Power Struggle. It's found on page 166 if you have the book and want to read along. And when I wrap up, I will share a little something about the back of the book, because Lizette shared some things about the front of the book, and there's some cool gems in here. So here we are. Here's my essay. Again, it's called Power Struggle. Comedian Paul Mooney said it best in Chris Rock's Good Hair documentary. If your hair is relaxed, white people are relaxed. If your hair is nappy, they aren't happy. This thinking is the reason many Black girls grow up with wash day stories laced with the pain of altering unacceptable natural coils. We've internalized outside perceptions and woven them into the fabric of our identities. Our hair, like our lives, has always been dissected, policed, and in need of taming, leaving us with skewed views of ourselves, our beauty, and our value. In sixth grade, much like Lizette just explained, my inquisitive blonde teacher called me to the front of the class. The school was predominantly white and Christian. I was one of a handful of Black students, though prior to this day, that hadn't really mattered much. As I walked to the front of the room, my freshly braided curls, which mother had done the night before, dangled well past my shoulders and bounced with each step. I stood next to my teacher, facing all the students from the front of the room, as she pinched one of my curls between her thumb and index finger and asked, "Is this real?" In that moment, my teacher and I were physically next to each other, but existed worlds apart. What could I say? Answering no would acknowledge that I was flawed, in need of enhancements to help me blend in, and clearly I wasn't blending. I lied. "Yes, this is your hair? It seemed much shorter yesterday." "Yes, it is." I spread a story around the school about me having a product called Hair Grow Fast. Admitting to weave would be conceding to every stereotype and perception regarding Black hair. I was not going to be the bald-headed Black girl. I'm not sure whether it was my teacher's audacity or the question itself that offended me most. Apparently, this teacher felt comfortable dissecting me. I was the subject of the day's lesson without my approval. I can't explain what public inquiry does to a girl. Suddenly, parts of you are no longer solely yours. My hair was something to defend. I had to lie about it, contain it, justify it. I could do everything but wear it, because someone always had something to say. When I say Black hair is political, I prefer to borrow writer and activist Muzamba Hanyama's definition from her essay, Untangling the Knots, Understanding the Hair Politics of Black Women Revisited. She states, "Conversations about Black women's hair are necessarily political. And by political, I mean involving both power struggle and negotiations. My sixth grade experience was a power struggle and negotiation. My teacher used her authority to dissect me, and I had to sacrifice the truth to maintain some semblance of dignity. This exchange was one of my first lessons in survival, compromise and perform. It was a microcosm of the much larger issue of which Hanyama was speaking. In many ways, starting with our hair, society asks us to perform identities for the comfort of those around us, specifically for the comfort of those in power. Our performance is too often an expectation of conforming to rules and standards that uphold an exclusionary norm. The result is that daily decisions about our experience and our appearance shift from personal preferences and self-edifying expressions to public breeding grounds for pushback, scrutiny, and critique. When I decided to lock my hair in May 2019, it was a personal decision, much like a decision anyone else makes to color, cut, or style their hair. I found and still find locks to be more fitting for my active lifestyle. However, in making that choice, I subjected myself to an even greater power struggle than the one I experienced in sixth grade. I placed myself in the box with Chastity Jones, a young Alabama woman who interviewed for a job and received an offer with the condition that she cut her locks. When Jones inquired why she needed to cut her hair, The human resources manager informed her, they tend to get messy. Not that yours are, but you know. What exactly do we know? We know that Jones's job offer was rescinded because she refused to comply. We know that locks are historically one worn by people of the African diaspora. We know that by hiding behind a race-neutral grooming policy that requires a business professional image where excessive hairstyles and unusual colors are unacceptable, we are, however covertly, saying that the acceptable image is one that demands that Black women negotiate and conform. That is what we know. Sadly, Jones's story progressed through a 6-year court battle, ending with a 2016 ruling that upheld the dreadlocks ban, prohibiting dreadlocks like the ones I wear today in the workplace. The court's stance was that while hairstyles are culturally associated with race, they are not immutable physical characteristics. In other words, as Black people, we have the ability to alter our hair and conform. One of my earliest hair memories is conforming. A baptism into Black womanhood, commonly known as wash day. I would bend down into the gushing faucet water and rise up with a shriveled bush. The tangled, dripping mass emerging from the sink was never acknowledged as beautiful. With conditioner trickling down my forehead, I stared in the mirror. And I told myself, no one can ever see me like this. The process to make me presentable took hours. If you ask any Black woman about the infamous wash day, you're likely to hear a story about sitting in the kitchen with an older Black woman and a hot comb. The goal was to look as far from natural as humanly possible because that is truly what was meant by getting your hair done. The shriveled bush from our baptism needed to be stretched and tamed because good hair was viewed as long and flowing. Our shrinkage, hair that coils tightly in its natural state, had to be dried, fried, and laid to the side. The hot comb was the most dreadful part of wash day. As if blow drying my bush wasn't stressful enough with all the tugging, tangles, and heat, my mother also had to press it out. She'd always take the heated comb fresh from the stove, set it on a folded paper towel to cool, and then starting with the shortest peasy strands in the back of my head, she would pick up the hot comb, blow on it, and rake through my hair. I sat, cringing internally, because doing so outwardly meant getting burned. This was the process of looking pretty. Squirming in the kitchen, fearing the sizzling hot comb, and waiting for the torture to end. As far as I knew, there were no other options. My hair was unmanageable, and no one could see me like this. My Blackness needed to be contained. As a young girl, the only images of Black hair in its natural form that I saw on television were women on plantations, working the field, or fighting for freedom. Whenever I saw my natural hair in the mirror, I saw those women. I felt I, too, belonged on a plantation, working in a field. My hair was fighting for freedom. It was short, untamed, and a sign of inferior status. Spoken or unspoken, our mothers pressed out more than our hair. They burned into our minds a new understanding of self. We were only good enough to be accepted if we made adjustments. I didn't understand the impact of these internalizations until my college years when I made the commitment to see myself as beautiful. I started wearing my hair in its natural form. Even if I didn't feel attractive, I trained my brain to equate my textured hair with beauty. The truth is that in my American story, I rarely get to see myself through my own eyes. I'm compelled to view myself from the perspective of others. W.E.B. Du Bois called this dilemma double consciousness. In his popular book, The Souls of Black Folk, Du Bois said, "It is a peculiar sensation, this double consciousness, the sense of always looking at oneself through the eyes of others. One ever feels his two-ness. An American, a Negro, two thoughts, two warring ideals, and one dark body. When I think of the fight to see my hair as normal, acceptable, and attractive, I think of these words, an internal warring. What appears to be a simple, mutable characteristic to the outside world is really an extension of a deeply rooted societal tension. Our hair is not our own. It is another part of us that is subject to policing. Audre Lorde captured this conflict in her 1990 essay, Is Your Hair Still Political? She states, the obsession with African-American hair is deeply ingrained in the American psyche. This statement remains true today. As a society, we have internalized misconceptions and passed them down through generations. For Black people, these internalizations can create a self-hate no person should ever have to endure. We should never look in the mirror thinking something is wrong with the way God made us. We shouldn't have to compromise parts of ourselves to blend in or fit anyone else's norm. Our differences are not a subject for public critique. Our hair is personal. As a sacred, uniquely beautiful part of the African diasporic experience, our hair is an entry point into our world. In America, it represents centuries of fighting to be seen as human rather than other, to exist without policing, and to live without conforming. Our hair, like our lives, makes others uncomfortable, and that is a burden we have carried for far too long. It is not our job to make others feel comfortable. It is our job, however, to control the narrative. We do this with representation, by proudly wearing our kinky, curly, coily, puffy hair in professional and educational spaces. The more we see pro athletes like Serena and Venus Williams, or celebrities like Viola Davis boldly rocking their braids and afros on TV screens, the more confident we become, knowing we too can do the same. We can be ourselves and still be beautiful. We can be ourselves and still be employed. We can be ourselves and still be successful. At this point in my life, I choose to wear my hair in ways that will give my future daughter the freedom to see, love, and accept her natural coils. I haven't quite figured out how I will teach her to navigate teachers like the one I had in sixth grade, or how to counter unfair laws. But if Paul Mooney was right about the nappiness and relaxation of our hair, I will make sure my daughter knows that she will make some white people very unhappy. Regardless, that will never be a reason to conform. Our hair is an entry point into our world, and we will continue to rock it just as we please. So that was my essay. Thank you for listening. And like Lizette said, there are tons of different stories and experiences captured in this book. And then at the end, what I think is really cool that I recently discovered is there's a reader discussion guide in the back of the book. So if you wanted to have these conversations in your workspaces or in other places, there's opportunity for that. And there's also a resource guide for additional reading, for expos that happen both nationally and internationally, and other things about the topics that are discussed in this book. So if you haven't already gotten your copy, definitely check it out. And if you would like to know more about me, my information will be on the screen. So I'm going to pass it over to Lizette to do her reading, and then we'll chat at the end.
Thank you. Thank you, Jasmine. That was neat. I haven't heard you read some of those sections before, so that was awesome. Thank you. Okay. I am going to go ahead and read. I'm going to do something a little different. I'm going to read a series of vignettes from the first essay I have in the book, which is called Toward Decolonizing Our Roots. And what I'm going to do is read a series of personal vignettes, and then I'll kind of circle back to some of the more political and critical and analytical passages. Okay, and these will be excerpts, so if you're following along, it will be not linear. Toward Decolonizing Our Roots. It was just my third day on the job. I was still learning to use the fax machine, a newfangled contraption that everyone in the office viewed with diffident deference. The company was small, comprising 8 employees. Co-workers had taken me out for lunch on my first day, minus one team member who was on vacation. As Irene and I, Irene at that time was my assistant, were tinkering with the recalcitrant printer, he knocked on our door and walked in. A portly man in his late 30s with a shock of russet curls and sporting a bright white shirt and a polished silver watch, he came over to introduce himself with a nut-cracking handshake. I returned to my desk and politely inquired about his vacation. We made small talk, then business speak, back to small talk. Only so much to be said about the weather, the traffic, and the mayor. A column of silence rose between us. His gaze alighted on my head. "How did you get your hair like that?" He reached across my desk and ran all 5 fingers of his right hand through my shoulder-length braids. So at this time, I was wearing Casamance braids. I seized his arm mid-arc, gripped it just hard enough to signal my spirit, and knocked it away with a fisted hand. I stared at him, letting a new foul silence shroud us for several seconds. 3/4 of letting a lance hit its target is timing. "If you want to touch my hair," I said, "you ask first. And when you do ask, I'll say no." Shock and puzzlement leaped through his features. I read the question marks and a flash of apprehension in his eyes. He flushed several shades of red, pivoted, exited. "Do you wash those?" She, a fellow strap hanger, blonde, on New York's uptown Lexington Avenue Express. Although we didn't know one another, we waited in the same area of the subway platform each morning and often wound up riding together, exchanging nods and smiles. "Wash what? Your braids?" I wrinkled my brow and tilted my head, affecting a perplexed posture. I was wearing dreadlocks at the time. "These aren't braids." "Yeah, they are." "No, they're not. What do you call them? Dreads?" "Dreads? As in dreadlocks." "Do you wash them?" "Of course I wash them. It's my hair. You wash yours, don't you?" "I didn't know you were Rasta." "I didn't either. Thanks for enlightening me." I'm in my high school's infirmary. My math teacher dispatched me there in the middle of class when she noticed sweat beads jeweling my face. I sit in a small room, marveling that though I'm in a clinic, the room is devoid of any semblance of care or comfort. The chair's metal legs are cold, a gadget in one corner beeps, an array of menacing devices hang along the far wall, and a stench of illness and caustic cleansers rinses over me. Outdoors, the temperature is in the 70s, but in here, I'm wearing 2 sweaters and shivering. My throat is blazing. My skin is clammy. I'm sporting a jerry curl, but can't even feel the juicy locks lapping my forehead. The nurse standing over me in unrelieved white, including wavy white hair and a crisp nurse's hat, asks me to describe my symptoms. I tell her my head feels like a melting candle with a low wick. Shadows of bafflement and astonishment scud across her face. The school, predominantly white and private, has a bucolic campus, a dress code, a swimming pool, no graffiti, and a 2-hour entrance exam. I've seen that phased look on faculty faces. Instructors were faculty here, not merely teachers. Directed at me numerous times in the school's Spartan classrooms. I know what the look means, and I'd normally take a little wicked pleasure in their shock at my precise creative diction, but I'm too sick to care. The nurse inserts a thermometer under my tongue and stands beside my chair as we wait. All I want to do is slide into one of the infirmary beds and go to sleep. I feel a sudden pressure in the center of my scalp, a series of dabs. I tilt my head up to see the nurse leaning over my hair with an expression of wonder, her mouth slightly ajar, her eyebrows arched. I slide down in the chair to ease away from her pawing. She laughs warmly and says, I just had to touch it. We're in New York, but a southern accent coats her syllables. She withdraws the thermometer and declares I have a fever of 101. I tell her I want to call my mom and go home. I want to tell my mom I need to return to public school. I can't remember her name. I can't remember the year. I recall she was in Boston, and I know it was the 1990s. She tended the front desk of a Tony Hotel, the kind of place with pearly shampoo bottles in the bathroom, sumptuous pressed robes on the door hook, pillowed gold foil Godiva squares. She sported a new, intricate pattern of braids. Guests traced her glimmering plates with their eyes. They complimented her. Management did not. Management was alarmed. Management, in fact, demanded that she remove the braids and return to her perm, a style befitting a post at her lacquered mahogany station. Ms. Boston was fire. She left her braids in. Dismissal followed. She sued under Title VII. I can't remember her name, and she wouldn't know mine, but the night her story aired, I began growing out my relaxer. Having withstood a combined 30 years of the terrorizing hot comb, the interminable relaxer salon appointment, and the succulent Jerry Curl era, I chose Senegalese Casamance braids. I stood in solidarity with Ms. Boston, yoking the miles, shoulder to shoulder, sister to sister. Though I'd worn various braided styles and TWAs ever since the time of the Boston Hotel affair, TWAs, for those who don't know, means teeny weeny afros. I've worn dreadlocks for the past 8 years. 1 month ago, as I was walking my dog in my San Francisco neighborhood, I passed a white man draped in scruffy, loose garments. His eyes followed me as I walked past him. When I reached the middle of the block, he called out, I like your snakes. They're really pretty. Since only I, he, and my dog were on the block at the moment, I knew he was addressing me. I ignored him. My dog stopped to do his business. As I scooped it up in a doggy bag and walked on, the man called out again, in rapid-fire speech, to my retreating back. Your snakes. I really like them. They're so neat. I like the color. I felt the involuntary dip in the center of my tongue that perennially preceded an obscenity-laced remark issuing from my mouth. By the grace of God, I checked my spleen. I didn't acknowledge the man. I continued strolling with my dog, no slower and no faster than before, and turned the corner. I'm at a 2019 Thanksgiving potluck dinner at a friend's house with nearly 20 people in attendance. I've brought homemade apricot cream cheese cookies and a bottle of Moscato d'Asti. Other than the host's housekeeper, I am the only Black person there. The housekeeper, Ayla, is not relegated to a subservient role. Rather, she joins us in the parlor for hors d'oeuvres and chatter in between checking on the ham, fish, and 15-pound turkey in the home's sumptuous kitchen. Ayla's skin is the color of sorrel, and she sports a crown of tapered natural spirals, but her head is shaved down to stubble on both sides above her ears. Her accent conjures up honeyed memories of ginger beer and ponche crema, drinks that my mother's Trinidadian friend gifted my family during my childhood. When a lull opens in the conversation, Ayla smiles and says to me, "I love your dreads. They're beautiful." I return her smile and say, "Thank you." Though I'm wearing a brown beret on my head to complement my brown and gold outfit, my hair hangs loosely about my shoulders. All the guests turn to look at me, nodding and murmuring their admiration. Ayla asks me, "But that's not your hair, is it? Where did you get the extensions?" The smile recedes from my face like a retreating ocean wave. "These aren't extensions," I say. "It's my hair." "That's your real hair?" Ayla asks. Her eyebrows arch on the question. "Yes, it's mine," I reply. Ayla nods, appearing surprised and impressed. The lull returns. "When I first started, they were tiny two-strand twists," I add, feeling compelled to expound. "I've been growing these out for nearly 5 years." "They're gorgeous," one of the men says, reaching for a small container of ceviche. "I wish I could wear dreadlocks." I look at Ayla. "Where are the rest of your curls?" The question arcs from my mouth like a ribbon of viper venom, this time without the advanced warning of a tongue dip. The guest's gazes swivel to Ayla. She throws her head back and laughs, a wild rocking chord that reverberates in the small parlor. "Oh, I just shave it off," she says, "so I only have to maintain the top. My hair is too much bother. I'm busy. I don't have time for it." If you are an optimist, a staunch one, it's quite likely that you feel the black hair politics of earlier decades are passé, even gauche. After all, we are well into the 21st century, and with a raceless Gen Y blooming, we're all grown up. Structural inequities continue to exist, of course, alongside educational disparities and myriad other unresolved race complexities. But what happened to Ms. Boston in the early 90s wouldn't happen today, right? It certainly shouldn't happen today. But we know that it does. While Ms. Boston had the ability to act on the courage of her convictions, not everyone does. Many women cannot afford to contest the status quo for fear of losing their jobs or losing opportunities to advance at their jobs. Women may desire to go natural, but they must consider a breadth of plausible consequences before they can do so. How will changing their hair impact their income stream, their upward mobility, the ability to be seen, heard, and respected in meeting rooms? This perception assessment concerning our hair is perversely preponderant for African-American and Afro-Latina women. How many women of other races must perform this tightrope calculus before deciding whether to sport a new hairdo in the workplace? Tina Opie and Catherine Phillips make this astute observation with regard to these laden decisions. Quote, "Afrocentric hair makes race salient, which may trigger negative stereotypes of Blacks. In turn, Blacks may engage in social identity-based impression management strategies, that is, de-emphasize social identity traits that signal group membership, to manage the impact of these negative stereotypes on others' perceptions of their competence and character. Concerns about professional image construction may lead Black women to conform to Eurocentric appearance standards and suppress identity traits." I think I'll stop there. Thank you. And now we are going to enter discussion. Jasmine and I are going to talk about some of the questions that I have in the back of the book. Jasmine, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, there you are. Awesome.
Right. I love those vignettes. I don't think I've heard you read a lot of vignettes. So that was, I was like taking notes. I enjoyed it.
Thank you. I enjoyed yours too. We both did something different.
Yeah.
Okay. My first question for us to discuss, let's see, there's so many juicy ones. I'm interested in your opinion on this, though.
Okay.
So, in the 1960s, mm-hmm. the Afro hairstyle came to represent the Black is Beautiful model mm-hmm. and the civil rights movement. Does the message of I am not my hair conflict with using hair mm-hmm. to demonstrate political beliefs and make social change?
Ooh. Oh, wow. That's a good question. So I feel like the first thing I wanted to say is like, no, but now I have to figure out like why that's coming up. Because I can very much see how it's like a contradiction.
Yes.
Yeah. So I guess what I think of, let me start with dissecting what I am not my hair means to me.
Okay.
And then see if I arrive at an answer as I talk.
Fair enough.
So when I hear I am not my hair, I think it means to me, for the outside gaze, not to make any type of like judgment or othering of me because of my look. Mm-hmm. So like, I remember when I first went natural and started wearing my twists, which, you know, they shrink. So they're like, up yes. here. Like so many people, even in my close circle, were like, are you going to do your hair? Or like, what's that? You know, there were just these comments. And so it's like, yo, this is not all that I am, I think was like the idea.
Mm-hmm.
But then when I think about the fro and the, like it being like an expression, of who I am.
Yes.
Yeah, I could definitely even though I don't want it to be, but yes. Yeah.
I mean our hair is also an accessory, right?
Mm-hmm.
So just like I am not my shirt
mm-hmm.
and I am not my bracelet and I am not my earrings. I can say I am not my hair, but I can wear a shirt that has a certain logo on it. I can wear mm-hmm. a Black Lives Matter shirt. Mm-hmm. I can wear an MLK Junior Day shirt. I can wear bracelets from the continent
mm-hmm.
and not have people draw the same outsized conclusions that they do just based on my hair. And you said even people in your inner circle were asking, when are you going to get your hair done? I get from fellow African-Americans, they assume that I'm Rastafarian
mm-hmm.
because I'm wearing dreadlocks. Mm-hmm. And it happens a lot out here in the Bay Area for some reason. So I've literally had people run after me and say, if you're looking for some good weed, I can point you to where to get some.
Right.
Yes, yes. And it's the assumption that happens within the community and also the assumption outside the community, outside, that I must be militant, that I must be mm-hmm. angry, you know, that I must be all the time, 24/7, an angry Black woman.
Mm-hmm.
And they would be very surprised to find out the types of things I read and the type mm-hmm. of things I watch and so on that don't line up with that narrative.
Right.
So I'm going to staunchly insist that I am not my hair, especially because nobody else is assumed to be their hair.
Right.
And it's a symbol, it's a crown, it connects me to my culture, but just like you wouldn't assume who somebody else is just based on whether they're wearing braids that day or a ponytail or an updo, I would ask that you not make those assumptions about me either.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So kind of thinking about it after hearing you talk and thinking about some other experiences, like one that comes to mind. They always happen at work. If I ever wore my fro
yes.
to work, it happened once when I taught, I would wear like my fro and then I wear like you know, dress clothes. And one a fellow African-American coworker was like, you have to choose one. You can't be Afrocentric and European at the same time, because my clothes were European and my hair was Afrocentric. And then another, like years before that, when I worked at a diner and I wore my fro, as soon as I walked in, another, again, black coworker was like, who did he call me? I forget, but he called, I think like Angela Davis, and like put his fist up.
Did he actually do this?
He did. He put the fist up and everything. And so I guess it's like, I can be black and proud, and that's still not all of who I am. Like, yes. Like if you were to combine both statements and realities together.
Yes. Yes. Okay.
That's a good one.
All right. Let's see. How are we doing? I'm going to leave. Okay. How about one more? How about this one? Does the Crown Act, even if it does pass nationally, does the Crown Act truly align with American values? If you look beyond the legislation's language to its possible applications, does it truly align with American values? I know what I'm going to say, but I want to hear what you say about that.
Actually, I want to hear you start first on this one.
Okay. I'm going to say that it does not. Because the truth of the matter is that we shouldn't need legislation in the first place. Nobody else needs legislation to protect their hair, right? We shouldn't need legislation in the first place to protect our hair. That's just silly. It's ridiculous. However, you know, if we don't want to be discriminated against or told that our hair is unprofessional when we show up for work, or have our children sent home and dismissed because they're wearing a natural hairstyle, then we do need, unfortunately, protection. But doesn't the fact that we actually have to enact that protection fly right in the face of what America is supposed to be about, and the Constitution and the Civil Rights Act and Plessy versus Ferguson and all of that stuff? And I do want to mention that I have heard from a lot of Native American men who have been reading the book or following the blog, and they mentioned that they need the Crown Act as well, because they wear their hair long. And even if they go, I've heard this countless times, they go to an interview with their hair neatly braided down their back. Yes, it's long, but it's neatly braided down their back. And they're still told, we want to offer you the position, but you'll have to cut your hair. Which they cannot do in certain tribal cultures because it's part of their heritage.
Right.
And sometimes that hair has real meaning for them, you know, ancestral meaning, and even energy and things of that sort. So interesting that a Crown Act has to be passed to protect everyone except the dominant culture.
Right, right.
So does it really align with American values?
Right, okay. So I think I would naturally like fully agree with your answer as well. I'm gonna push a little bit and say, I think it aligns with American values on paper, in the sense that this is supposed to be the nation of liberty and justice for all. So if that were the case, then yes, this aligns, right? The ability to wear your hair. I think the disconnect that's always existed in our country is the what we say on paper versus like execution, or like at the time those papers, the ink was drying on those papers, we still had a lack of acknowledgement for like who was included in that language. And so I think when you look from that lens, that aligns with like what you said of if we truly lived out what we established this nation to be, we wouldn't need these additional protections. But because that's not what we're actually founded on, then there's a little more nuance to it.
Yep. It's shameful in some ways, really. But anyway, I hope West Virginia is listening to this, since they disappointed me tremendously in the past couple of weeks. Let's see. Maybe time for one more, and then I'll open it up. We have 75 minutes.
Okay, cool.
Let's see. Actually, I'm going to ask this. What is your earliest memory of having someone touch your hair without your permission? What's your very earliest memory? Unless it's the one that you read in the book.
Yeah, I think that's the only memory I have of it, actually. I don't remember. Oh, no. Wow. Okay, but this is completely different. And it's very bizarre, actually. When I was in daycare, we had like nap time, as most daycares do. And from my recollection, all the students were like Black or, you know, of the diaspora. And one day I got these beads, which I didn't get normally because my dad always felt like I had an extra assassin attitude when I had beads. So he was like, she's not getting beads. But one time I had like either beads or barrettes in my hair. And when I woke up, they were all out my hair because this girl had like taken them while I was asleep and put them in her hair. Which is just super bizarre. And then I got in trouble for it. Like, I was supposed to know.
Why did you get in trouble for it?
They were like, you should have known. Like, you didn't know. She was, no, I was asleep. But I got in trouble for not knowing. So it's kind of, you know, different from, like, the topic of what we're talking about. But that was definitely probably the first time someone touched my hair without consent.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. Let's see. For me, I think it was in kindergarten, and my sister and I also had the beads. We went to the bead stage. So long before Venus and Serena brought it, little Black girls were wearing the beads in their hair. And it was another child, predominantly white, kindergarten, even though it was public school. I think there was one Asian girl in there, and then I was the only other person of color. And we were drawing these life-size, like these poster-sized pictures of ourselves and cutting it out. And I was drawing the hair on it. And one of this little white kid, who every now and then would call me the N-word, came over and said, you're not drawing your hair right. You're drawing it like it's curly. And he reaches out and he goes, and it's not really curly. It's like, it's more stiff, and you should draw it like that since we're supposed to be drawing ourselves.
Wow.
And then other kids were there, and they're like, yeah, you know, yeah, they were chiming in. Yeah, you know, that's what you should do. And that was kindergarten.
Right.
This little five-year-old kid, what was his name? Chris Meyer. I can still remember it. Little blonde kid. And every now and then would refer to me as the N-word, which at first I didn't know what it meant.
Okay.
And then I started getting a sense that, it doesn't sound real great. And one day I told my parents about it at dinner. And my mom was just real upset. My dad said, when you go to school tomorrow, if he calls you that, punch him in the teeth. And don't come home until you've done that.
Right.
So,
right.
You know.
Yep, standard teachings.
Yep. the standard teachings, if you get in a fight, don't come home, don't show your ass at home unless you've won the fight, don't cry. If you do cry, you continue to fight while you're crying, etc. So all those tough lessons.
Right.
Okay. Okay, I see our first question.
Yay. Do you want me to read it?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay. In the absence of a national crown act, have you heard any good news about companies that are standing up for natural hairstyles and creating policies for their staff or potential new staff? Great question.
Well,
I'm going to refer to you because I know you've been on top.
Yeah, I mean, in California, I probably will not hear that because now we have a Crown Act here. And we're the state that has had it for the longest.
Mm-hmm.
So I will just say that prior to the Crown Act, I had not heard about any companies standing up for these hairstyles. Now, after the Crown Act, there have been some problems where employees were told, maybe you can do something to make your hair a little more professional. We're having the board come in tomorrow or something like that. And now those people can point to the Crown Act and say, what are you talking about? The first test of the Crown Act here is a gentleman in San Diego named Jeffrey Thornton, who was told that in order to work in the San Diego office of the company that he was working for, he originally worked in Florida with no problems, by the way, with his dreadlocks. Mm-hmm. He came to San Diego and they said he would have to cut his locks in order to work in the San Diego office. And he did sue. The Crown Act was maybe a year old.
Oh, wow. That.
And so that was making its way through the courts. And of course, at that time, the company then backpedaled and said, oh, no, Mr. Thornton misunderstood us. That's not what we meant. Of course, you know, we're offering him the job, blah, blah, blah. There's been a lot of that type of backpedaling now. What about you? What about
in Philadelphia on the East Coast? I haven't heard anything. If anything, I've heard like the opposite of like stories in DC of, you know, people not being able to wear their hair naturally, particularly locks. I haven't had any issues, fortunately. I've been locked now since 2019. So going on what, 5 years now?
Yeah.
So I haven't had any, well, actually I've been self-employed for four of those years. I just started working again. But my job, you know, doesn't seem to have any issue. So that's good. Mm-hmm. And like I was telling you earlier, even though it's not like workspace, I've been seeing a lot more people in and around Philadelphia with like beautiful locks. Mm-hmm. So I think it's becoming a lot more accepted. Mm-hmm.
I love seeing all of the sisters now on newscasts, you know, anchors that are
really
natural.
Yes.
Bows or locks, or I don't know if I've seen braids yet.
I have seen braids on out here on Fox, actually. I think she's Fox.
Really?
I think she's Fox, if I'm not mistaken. Okay. But yeah, there's an anchor on Fox. She had, and it, well, it's funny because it's a show where they're kind of like comical.
Okay.
And so like normally her hair is like curled, and then one day she had the braids, and so her co-anchor was like, something's different. And like it was like, you know, like their skit. It was so cute. So yeah, but I was like, oh, they let her do that. Let her. You know, like, it's nice to see.
Awesome. So sorry, the Sierra Life, that we don't have more uplifting responses to your question.
I have a question for you as an extension of that, though. What is the role of Dove in the Crown Act? Because I see them on like the page and the petition.
Yeah, so Dove actually is part of the Crown Coalition, and they headed it. They headed it. And the coalition is a large conglomerate of different organizations. And so the Crown Act, if you go to their website, it is a Dove website.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And if you want to, you know, lift the skin and look underneath, Dove wants our spending dollars. We spend a lot of money on beauty products in general, hair, skin, makeup. So I think that they are kind of riding the BLM move, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement that swelled in 2020.
Mm-hmm.
So many companies jumped on that bandwagon. And I think Dove is trying to say, well, for us, it's more than a bandwagon. We're trying to do something more about it.
Right.
But I still feel that the true motivation underneath it all is primarily monetary.
Gotcha.
And also a good public relations, you know, face.
Mm-hmm.
So they are the head of the Crown Coalition, is what it's called.
Okay. Gotcha. Cool. Okay.
In fact, I'll see if I can get a list of the Crown Coalition while we look for the next question to come
in. Got you. Well, let me see if a question comes up in the book that I want to ask. And if you all want to ask us questions, please do.
Don't be shy. You can ask anything.
Great.
Can I jump in and ask a question?
Yes, please. Yes,
you are allowed to.
I have a question, and it might be related to Dove and might not, but the Equal Justice Society here in based in Oakland is working on litigation related to Black women's who has experienced adverse or devastating health impacts because of hair products. Can you speak about that a little bit? and things.
Yeah. There are a couple of initiatives like that happening. Not a lot, but there are a couple like that happening around the country. And just for those who don't know, we're primarily speaking about relaxers. And relaxers are this horrible mixture of extremely caustic chemicals. And it's if you know about the 1950s experiment where a chemist took the ingredients of a relaxer and put it on a can, and it actually ate a hole through the can. So it's very caustic. If you ever had a relaxer, you'll know that after it goes on, after just a few minutes, it'll start to burn. And that burn grows more and more until your scalp is in pain, right? But you leave it on because you're trying to get your hair as straight as possible. How could it possibly be healthy and okay to have something that burns your scalp? And sometimes people would get scalp burns from having it on and leaving it on too long. So the chemicals in this have been linked to a number of possible illnesses and conditions and diseases, including breast cancer and endometrial cancer, and the incidences of these cancers among Black women. That is interesting to know. I did not know Oakland was doing that. Desmond, did you want to weigh in?
I think I missed a part of the question. Can you restate it for me?
Jason?
Sorry for the delay. Too many buttons to push. No, I was just talking about, because there's litigations related to the health impacts of hair products, and I was just curious of your experiences, stories, and maybe if it's related, like if the Crown Act will contribute to awareness or not, or just your personal experience. And
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So out here, I think I've even seen like a billboard for like, if you use this, we call them perms. So if you use this type of perm, you may be, you know, eligible for. So there's definitely been.
Oh, are they doing that already?
Yes.
Might be eligible for a settlement or that type of thing.
I think so. Yeah. Or like, you know, content. I've definitely seen. I'm not a big, like, I don't have live TV, but yes. I've seen like an ad somewhere. Yes. I've definitely seen a billboard. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I've gotten emails, but it's out and it's pretty, I would say, because a lot of my life is very curated. So the fact that I've seen it multiple times, yes. I'm like, yes. It's definitely out there.
Okay.
Yeah. And fortunately I didn't have any, negative experiences with the perm, other than the fact that, for those who don't know, like if you use a perm, your hair doesn't go back to its natural state. It has to grow out, and you know, you cut it off. So outside of like stopping it in 2005, when I graduated from high school, so that I could have my natural hair. Fortunately, like it didn't burn my hair out or anything like that. Uh-huh. But you know, if you leave it in too long.
Yes.
Yeah. Yep. Webster's.
I see someone texted you a question.
Yes.
Does the Crown Act include African headdresses? I have not read language in the act about the headdress, only about the hair and about texturism, which is what it's focused on. I'd be interested if someone has been discriminated against in the workplace or at school for wearing any of the headdresses, such as a turban or a giclée, any of the African headdresses.
So that's an interesting conversation, because I know you said like people have like missed school, for example, because of discrimination. But I always felt like if my hair was not done, like that would be a reason that I would like miss school or work, even though I didn't. I actually had perfect attendance in school, but like I would want to. And I think the only reason in high school that I may not have is because I used to take like the t-shirt and wrap it. You know, so you have a style, you know, it would be a style, you put your hoops on.
Yes.
But I do know that at high schools I taught at, where the majority, like 98% of our student body were like African-American students, the girls weren't allowed to wear headscarves and things like that. And it wasn't, I mean, if it was like, obviously for religion and stuff, that was fine. Mm-hmm. But like, I'm like, oh no, I wouldn't have survived because those teachers were like,
yep.
So that's interesting because, you know, it's not necessarily like a cultural headdress per se.
Right.
You know, but it is kind of needed for other cultural reasons. Yeah. So I don't know.
It's not a cultural headdress, but it is still a cultural practice.
Right. Exactly.
That comes down through the generations. So that is interesting.
Yeah.
I have never thought of that. I don't believe the Crown Act addresses headdresses.
Yeah. The person who asked me that question just said in their previous job, they did not allow them to wear hats or African head wraps.
What?
Yeah. And if I'm not mistaken, it wasn't a city job, but yeah.
It was a what job?
I was thinking it was a city job, but it's not. It wasn't a city job.
But private industry.
Yeah. It was in the utilities field.
What if you wanted to wear a different kind of headdress that wasn't specifically African?
Right.
What if someone else wanted to wear a headdress?
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. It seems like there was no headwear. Like you come to work with your hair and that's it. Like,
oh, I wouldn't like that.
No covering. Yeah.
Okay, well, I see we're just about at time, so I will pass it back to Jason to close us out.
Well, first of all, I want to thank you so much for making the time and sharing your story, sharing your book. And I want to invite everyone who's listening to please pick up Trauma, Tresses, and Truth. It's now available at all bookstores. There's links in the description, links in the chat. Please pick it up, read it. And again, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having us.
Yes.
Yes, thank you.
And that's it. Thank you.
Have a great day, everyone.